Hello and welcome everyone to a new Impact Pool podcast. And today I'm here with Lisa Rubinstein. She is the head of impact at Carbon Equity and co-founder of Carbon Equity. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're here in their office in Amsterdam, so it's nice to have a live chat rather than online, so really enjoying that. Maybe I can just dive into it. Could you maybe share with us what your road in life has been and how has that led to where you're currently on?
Yeah, very happy to. I just told you we're sitting very close to the house I actually grew up in. So I grew up in Amsterdam, Dutch mother, Jewish Mexican father, lived in a few different places in the world. Both my parents are artists in a broader sense, and I think that was kind of the expectation for me too in a certain way. So the fact that I loved to learn and I loved science was a little bit out of the ordinary for my family, but very obvious for me to go to university rather than art school.
Yeah.
But there, and it's kind of looking back that you start to realize it, I think I was always kind of obsessed with the question where I wanted to make an impact. Career was never about making money or having power. It was always about impact. And I think it is because of my parents and my background that I was kind of instilled with this idea of make a contribution, make something that matters to other people, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like when you look back that you connect the dots. But I studied first liberal arts and sciences, decided to specialize in sociology and political science.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I once read an article, I think it was actually from B.F. Skinner, the psychologist who was like the godfather of stimuli response theory, who actually wrote a very unusual piece about like, okay, what's the problem in the world? We're very good at making new technologies, right? We've been doing it continually, but we're having a very hard time making sure that society in the broadest sense benefits from them.
Yeah.
And that was one of my light bulb moments where I was like, oh yeah, that's why I find it personally less satisfying to develop new technologies or be in science, because I'm kind of obsessed with how do we make sure most people benefit from it.
Yeah.
Hence the move to sociology and then political science. And then in my master's, I became a little bit disillusioned about national and transnational and international governments' ability to solve global problems.
Mm.
And I'm telling this to a UN audience, but...
No, that's okay.
When looking at climate change, I guess labor standards, back when I was in university, so this is 10 years ago, it was just a little bit of a depressing story. Like, our governmental institutions are really rather limited in their ability to solve these challenges where there is international competition between countries, and countries for their short-term interests are more interested in economic growth. So anyway, I continued on to, okay, so who else could potentially solve global problems like climate change? I went to corporates. I studied corporate social responsibility. And there, the conclusion was kind of, there's a lot of people with very good intentions in all of these corporates, but they are limited in their ability by shareholders. And then I came to the question, so what do shareholders want?
Yeah.
And which shareholders want more sustainability, and what are their methods of influence, and can those change the world?
Yeah.
So I did a big research project on shareholder engagement in the end, with active ownership. So if you own a stock, you can go to the AGM, the annual general meeting, vote on resolutions, you can file resolutions, and you can say, I will not file a resolution on the condition that we can have a private conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what engagement is about.
Yeah.
So I actually joined a whole bunch of those conversations. I was sitting there with my notepad kind of like scribbling away. And I studied kind of like, how do organizations actually change because of the conversations that shareholders are having?
Mm-hmm.
And the good news was that they did change, but the bad news that it was very incremental, like little steps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the best that we've got in public markets. So it's a little bit depressing. But I did two things. On the one hand, I did start volunteering for an organization called Follow This, who are doing shareholder engagement, but the radical way, not the incremental way. And I thought it was very inspiring. Been involved with them ever since I joined their supervisory board last year. And I went on to work at McKinsey, where I was like, okay, I still think it's corporates that hold the power and need to do the most to get to net zero. So let's understand them better.
Yeah.
But I joined right as sustainability work was taking off. And with my background and my enthusiasm, I got into a lot of those projects. So I ended up doing mostly energy transition work, really predicting the speed of the transition in different areas, helping different companies figure out their own decarbonization strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very interesting place to be.
Yeah.
Can talk a lot more about kind of the challenges of, on the one hand, really thinking the transition will go incredibly fast, and on the other hand, knowing that the customers are not ready to hear that, and then like, how do you middle that?
Why would you say the customer is not ready to hear that?
Well, try telling a car manufacturer company 7 years ago that electric vehicles are on an exponential growth path and they need to uproot, they need to start changing their business. If they don't, they will be out of business. We wanted to tell that story, but we showed them an exponential growth path.
Yeah.
They didn't believe it.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Exponential growth. Humans are not good at understanding exponential growth.
And why is that, would you say? I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah, so. Brains are just not wired for it. Like as the first kind of little bits of news of COVID came out, this was like probably months before lockdown, my then boyfriend was tracking them every day. And he said, like, the data's wrong. I'm seeing something linear and it has to be exponential because we're talking pandemics. And he saw coming that 2 weeks later we would be in lockdown. He ordered a face mask. Uh-huh. From Alibaba, and I thought he was crazy. Actually thought he was nuts.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, we went into lockdown, because it's like, if you understand how exponential paths work, things can change incredibly fast.
Right.
But we're not wired that way. Our brains don't function that way.
Mm. How would you say our brain functions then?
Linear.
Or linear. So how does that relate to investing?
Well... I'm not sure how to get to, I mean, we can talk about investing, but let's first talk transition, right?
Yeah.
So what happens is, for example, solar adoption, there's been fantastic charts. Maybe we can share one on the website where it's like, basically, if you predict how quickly solar adoption will go,
mm-hmm.
you take the trend from last year. So it was like 20% growth. So we'll just assume it's going to be 20% growth every year from now on.
Yeah.
But the point is, like, last year was 20% growth. The year before it was 17. The year before it was 12. And the year before it was 5.
Yeah.
So the growth trend increases. But every year we just, like, extrapolate linearly. Because if you continue the growth trend, you go up.
Yeah.
And steep. If you're very steeply, and if you're in a very early stage, trying to fathom that 5 years from now, that's going to be the dominant technology in the market, like, it just sounds nuts.
Yeah.
So how does that relate to investing? Well, certain technologies can grow really, really fast.
Yeah.
And that makes it really exciting to invest in climate tech or any kind of early stage innovative company.
Yeah. Hey, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your current company, Carbon Equity. I mean, I found it super intriguing what I read on the website, insofar as I understand it. Because it's clearly not my domain of expertise.
Yeah.
But yeah, tell.
So we came together with the founders. Our goal was, we want to create an investment product that has real climate impact. Because we want to invest in it ourselves, right? And we came to the conclusion, partially of the research that I've done, like, public markets is just not the place to be. It's too hard. You don't have real impact. On the other hand, what I learned at McKinsey was, like, we know really well which technologies we need to get to net zero. There's like a set of about 100 climate technologies, all of the IPCC trajectories to net zero, all of the kind of like ways of getting to net zero are based on that set of 100. Many of those still need to scale and become cost competitive, and we need to get better at making them.
Yeah.
So obviously that's where the money is needed.
Yeah.
And those companies are typically smaller and younger. These are startups and scale-ups that are developing these technologies and bringing them to market. So if you want to have real climate impact with your money, you want to invest in those kinds of companies.
See?
As a private investor, typically your only option to invest in those companies is on crowdfunding platforms, or maybe as an angel investor if you know someone in your personal network building one of these things.
Yeah, sure.
But it's very, very risky to invest in one startup, because one startup can go bankrupt and then your money is gone. So We wanted to create a really diversified product with our investment. You invest in 150 of those companies.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those will go bankrupt. Some of those will become unicorns. Many of them will do reasonably well, but you're spreading the risk.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, so maybe just to recap, so with one investment, you invest in 150 of those companies, but behind the scenes, the way it works is that we don't select those companies ourselves.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's too much work. And rather, there's a lot of really specialized teams doing that startup and scale-up investing.
Uh-huh.
These are venture capital funds, private equity funds, small teams, somewhere between 5 and 15 people typically, that raise a few hundred million. And they say, we're going to do European early stage agri-food, or we're going to do US carbon capture and removal scale-ups. So really quite niche, but they do that with a lot of dedication and depth. And so what we do is we pick the best of those teams.
Yes.
And we put those teams to work with our customers' money. Every year we start funds. So with one ticket in fund, you invest in 7 to 10 of those fund managers, and then that leads to the portfolio.
Okay. Yeah. I guess it's hard to predict where the profit will be.
Exactly. On two levels, right? So on one level, certain niches will grow faster than others. So right now, solar is growing a whole lot faster than alternative proteins. Mm-hmm. So that is going to be one consequence. But the other thing is that within a niche, you don't know which technology and which company is going to be the winner. So cement, for example, is a great example. I think we have 7 different companies in our funds now that are trying to solve cement. So cement is 5% of global emissions. I don't know if you know that.
No.
A lot of people don't know that. 5% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the world come from making cement. Why is that? You need to heat it to, I think, 1600 degrees, that inputs that you use. So to create that heat, you burn a lot of fossil fuels. And actually, making cement releases CO2.
Yeah.
You literally boil out the CO2 from limestone. And unless you capture that, that just goes into the air. So there's many different ways of solving that. One is we can just not use cement anymore, but use wood. Using wood to even build pretty high buildings, cross-laminated timber is the technology they typically call it. We're building, I think, buildings of 80 meters now with only wood. No steel, no cement, only wood. So that's really exciting.
Yeah.
So there's a few companies working on that. There's also different ways of electrifying steel making. So rather than going to 1600 degrees Celsius with all the cooking, you do it in a different way, only using green electricity.
Yeah.
That will solve half the problem. Then the other half of the problem is the CO2 that's released. You can capture that. There's companies dedicated on figuring out how to capture that CO2 effectively. And then there's yet others that are saying, we're not going to do it with electricity. We're going to see if we can do it with bacteria. So actually, okay. Bacteria have been found in like those underground caverns that where like really hot earth heat is released.
Uh-huh.
They found one bacteria that loves to eat limestone and poop out cement.
Wow.
Can you scale that?
Yeah.
One company's working on that.
And how did you find that? That's also wow.
Yeah. Oh, how they found that bacteria. Yeah, no, that's really, it's lovely to talk to these founders and their founder stories. And sometimes it's a complete coincidence. And sometimes it's like megalomaniac, like, I want to solve this problem. I'm going to research everything that exists in the world to see what I think the best solution could be.
Yeah, but that must be really inspiring to meet these people, right? And they have this vision and they really want to make it work.
Wow.
That's
even
great.
Just hearing the stories, I think for me at least, but I'm a little bit of a nerd, but just reading about these companies already gives me so much energy.
And then
the founders behind them is probably even better.
Wow. Hey, maybe where do you see opportunities and challenges? I mean, without this becoming like investment advice, so to speak. But more in general terms, so when it comes to climate solutions and investments in climate technology.
Maybe let's first talk sectors. So to get to net zero, there's 6 sectors that we need to transform.
Mm-hmm.
There's energy production, how we make electricity and fuels, industry, basically everything that we make, cement's in there. Then there's mobility, how we move around goods, how we move goods around. Agri-food, how we produce what we eat, how we manage the land that we have. Buildings, so how reheating and lighting up our buildings. And finally, carbon management. So we still need to capture CO2 and even take it directly out of the sky to stay below 2 degrees.
Right.
Those are the six. The way I'm currently looking at the transition is like, green electricity is probably the biggest revolution of the last 200 years, and it's only accelerating. So anything related to electricity, I'm really hopeful with. It starts with solar power. So solar power is now in 80% of the world cheaper than fossil fuel electricity.
Okay.
It's just cheaper. What does that mean? It means that the majority of all new power capacity that was installed last year was renewable. It just doesn't make sense to build fossil fuel power anymore, unless you're Russia. But if you have like your own fossil fuel reserves, maybe still a little bit, but mostly it's solar. And so it's still accelerating. Last year, built capacity of solar was 80% higher than the year before that. And
yeah,
60% higher than the year before that. I'll show you a chart. It's incredible. So solar is on the rise. Wind was mostly on the rise. Actually, today there was a big article in the Dutch press because Eneco, one of the biggest energy mm-hmm. companies, is saying right now it's hard to build wind energy because interest rates are high, supply chains are hard, labor is expensive. Anyway, but it's, in my view, those are temporary problems. But the bigger story, renewable power is on the rise. And that means that everything related to renewable power is on the rise. So whether it's platforms selling solar panels are on the rise, or companies doing solar panel maintenance are on the rise, or companies that help manage the grid. The electricity grid is not used to so much renewable power, right? All the electrons are flowing in different directions. So there's a whole lot of software companies
mm-hmm.
helping to manage the grid. Those are on the rise. And the second really hopeful thing is that we're getting better and better at using electricity for everything.
Yeah.
So compared to 5 years ago, we can do so much more with electricity. Heat pumps, the ones that you install in your house to heat your homes.
Yeah.
5 years ago, those weren't, especially air-to-air heat pumps, those weren't good enough to heat your homes on the coldest day of the year. And we thought they never would become good enough to do that. Now we're installing them in Canada and they work at minus 30 degrees Celsius. So what's happening? They're on an exponential growth path.
Yeah.
And they use renewable power, which is cheaper and more efficient and all of it. So same goes for industrial heat. We thought we would never be able to do that with electricity. We thought we would need hydrogen and biogas and other alternatives.
Yeah.
But like one after another, like really awesome companies are coming online that are doing heat pumps or thermal energy storage, like heat batteries where they electrify and then store it as heat and then deploy it as heat. So anything electricity to me, on the condition that the government will invest enough in the electricity grid, there's one big bottleneck, but otherwise, all of that is going rather well. And what's going less well, in my view, is the agri-food transition. So look at anything electricity and also alternative fuels and quite a few other things. There's a lot of government policy, there's a lot of corporate demands, there's a lot of consumer incentives, and there's a lot of growth. And then you look at agri-foods, and I don't know what's going to push the transition there, because the government's not as progressive, consumers are not as keen, and established interests are quite powerful. So that's the part I worry about.
Earlier on, you said, okay, when you found in your early career that, let's say the politics can be an obstacle, right? And you were just mentioning also Eneco, where they spoke about the worries that they have. So that brings me to the issue of scalability, right? So how does that work? Because there's all these great initiatives, but the scale in which, again, I might be naive in this, but the scale in which we need all of this is, at least I would think, enormous. So how does that...
Of everything we just talked about, or of agri-food?
No, more like let's focus on the electricity part.
Yeah.
You know, still that is a thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, talking about it globally, so
yeah.
Not Western Europe, where I guess things would be sorted out to an extent, but globally, so...
Yeah, no, so... This is, I think, with the transition was going well. So, for example, with electricity, well, by now, solar production capacity has scaled really rapidly already. There's even like there's an oversupply right now. There's more solar manufacturers than all of that demand that we just talked about, because, well, part of that is just China building an incredible amount of factories, but then also Europe, US wanting to have some of their own supply. The transition is never a very neat process, right? So demand increases, and for a period there's undersupply, then the suppliers see an opportunity, so they all start building factories. But if they all build them at the same time, suddenly there's oversupply. That's what you see, for example, now with wind power. Right now there's undersupply of, there's more demand for wind turbines than capacity. Well, that's a good business case. Let's build some more factories, and then maybe we'll build too many, but then after that demand increases. I think the main point is it takes time. It takes time. We need to build a lot of factories. And then we need to deploy a lot of it, right? So solar power, it's most of the stuff that's being installed today, but it's still less than 20% on the entire grid. And it's going to take another 15 years before everything that we've installed is actually renewable, because the lifetime of assets are 15 or 20 or 25 years. And it is also the thing with the companies that we invest in, that they have fantastic technologies, but it's going to take them a while to get the skill. And I think what's really interesting is you have kind of two kinds of companies. So you have the companies that are saying, we're going to do it fundamentally different. We will need to build our own factories, but it's going to be a full solution.
Yeah.
And then you have the companies that say, we're making something to make existing factories a little bit more efficient. CarbonCure is an interesting example. Again, in cement, what they do is they take CO2.
Mm-hmm.
They flip it around. They take CO2, they inject it into cement.
Okay.
Which also forms a chemical reaction and makes the cement lighter and stronger. So you're storing the CO2, but you're also making sure that you need less input materials to make the same amount of cement. Their machine is really, it's like three different tanks, and they can install them at existing cement factories. And it has a positive business case, and they're scaling really rapidly. Or another example, AI Crete is a company. All they do is they help improve cement mixture. So there's many different recipes of cement with different impacts.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be up to 20 or 30% lower carbon footprints if you only use like the optimal recipe. So they're, on their platform, you can like design different recipes, and that can be scaled really rapidly. And it's actually one of the things that we talk a lot about in our investment team, like how much do we want to focus on these breakthrough technologies that will take a lot of time to scale versus these incremental solutions that will definitely help us maintain our carbon budget, but eventually will not be good enough for net zero.
Yeah, interesting. So people that are investing, obviously you would think, you're investing money, so it's about money. But how would they see, or how do they generally see, if you can say something like that, what they look at in terms of investment? So is the return on investment, is that purely like, okay, we need to see that I get so much back in terms of profit?
Yeah.
Or is the profit also in the technology that they're investing in? So it's growing. So what is their motivation?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So we talk a lot about, right, when do our customers have success experience? When are they, do they feel like they achieved with us what they wanted to achieve? And the answer is both. So it is about return. It is about people are investing a significant amount of money with us. The minimum ticket is 100,000 euros right now. We want to go lower, but we're not there yet. We say we will do 2 to 3 times net return of their invested capital. So that is something that we're tracking and we're reporting on, and it matters to them.
Yeah.
The other thing that really matters to them is, what are they actually investing into? And at least for myself personally, also hearing about these companies and these technologies and just getting a sense of all the solutions that are being developed is the most hopeful thing.
Yeah.
And it's really exciting to share these stories. So we built our own portal. All of our customers can log in and they can read about every single of their companies that they've helped support.
Yeah.
And what it is they're doing. And right now what we're figuring out is, how do we kind of keep them engaged on the progress of these companies?
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of exciting news to share, whether it's follow-on investing rounds, so they're raising more money because they've achieved their milestones and their valuation has gone up, but also they have more capital to scale, or they're announced they're building a new factory, or they got a big government grant, or they got a big commercial contract. But as there's 150 companies in a portfolio, that's a lot of news.
Yes. Okay. That might be a bit too, if it was me, that would be a bit too much. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, so we're in the process of like, how do we balance this? How do we share the excitement without overwhelming our customers?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. I had a thought and now I lost it. Yeah. You said about this. So right now the portfolio is 100K, right? Euros. But how can people contribute? I mean, if they can't spend like the 100K, let's put it that way.
Contribute to the transition in the broader sense?
Yeah, or maybe you said, well, we're thinking about maybe changing it or...
No, we're working very hard on changing it. So we started this company with the vision to democratize access to real climate impact investments.
Yeah.
It's just that from a regulatory perspective, that's really complicated.
Okay, why is that?
Yeah, the financial governance of the financial sector was not designed for allowing smaller tickets in private equity funds.
Yeah.
We worked 2 years on getting a license, an AIFMD license, which in theory allows us to do it, but then there were additional hurdles. So there's a whole team working on this. One time we offered smaller tickets, we found one little hole in the legislation we could use one. So we have 140 smaller ticket customers starting at 10,000.
Yeah.
And the goal is to get back there.
Okay. That's, yeah.
In the meantime.
Okay, yes. Do share.
So while people won't be able to invest with us, I always urge people to think about your impact in the broader sense. So I think we talk a lot about our own carbon footprints and what we consume and what we can do there. And a lot of people are aware of meat and flying and whatnot. But I think there's a few other pillars of how you can have influence. Mm-hmm. According to research, the most important thing you can do is vote.
Vote.
Votes.
Okay.
Your vote is the most impactful thing you can do for the climate. And also in the US, that's not only about voting, but it's also about supporting certain lobbies, which is a little bit less relevant in Europe.
Yeah.
You can decide how to spend your time. So we work for 80,000 hours in our life. In the Netherlands, a big initiative was just launched, the School of Moral Ambition. And it's about how are you spending your time and what are you contributing towards?
Yeah.
And I think we're in a very exciting time where work is becoming less about only about making money and more about...
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you building?
Yeah.
And finally, think about your financial influence in the broader sense. So there's the capital you invest, but there's also the pension you save. Either you do it individually, and then you have a lot of freedom actually with how you invest that money. But if you're with one of the big pension funds, those funds are making big decisions about where their money is going.
Yeah.
The Netherlands has a few of the biggest pension funds in the world. We're a tiny country, but we have a ton of capital. And many other countries, especially in Europe, also big pension funds. So there you can raise your voice about how you would like that money to be invested.
Yeah.
The same goes for insurers. And there you actually also have the freedom to choose. And insurers also sit on very, very big pots of money.
Yeah.
And some of them put that money to use for the transition and other social objectives. And others do less so.
Yeah, no, that's actually good advice.
Yeah. There's websites and tools that help you assess the differences.
Yeah, no, exactly. Maybe also good to put in the article.
Yeah.
And I think also that the your comment to voting is an interesting one.
Yeah.
Speaking for, okay, we're both in Holland, you know, I think people get a little bit disillusioned sometimes with the voting system. And maybe we also became a bit complacent. We don't know what luxury we have. That's another story perhaps.
Yeah.
But
it's maybe you don't have the ideal option on the ballots. But it still makes a difference.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to ask a very different question. Since we're a bit of a recruiting platform, Impact Pool, what kind of specialities, this is very broad, of course, but what sort of specialities would you think companies that you have in your portfolio look for?
Our companies? Oh, it really depends on the type of companies, right? But there's always a team of engineers. There's always stuff being built, whether it's software or hardware. Yeah. And engineers that want to focus on a transition are in hot demand.
Yeah.
There's always need for good salespeople because you're building something new and people need to buy it.
Yeah.
Whether that's B2B or B2C, there's a whole lot of demand for good marketing people.
Yeah,
that know how to tell the story and build a brand.
Yeah.
And depending on the type of company, there's, I think, a very important skill to have is to design out the growth journey of a company and what kind of funding will be needed where, and to really guide that pathway to scale.
I think it's an interesting one because, of course, with Impactpool, we're kind of hosting like, you know, NGOs, UN-ish family, that stuff. But to my mind, these companies are a bit on the verge of both, right? They're clearly having a huge impact, but yet we see them as commercial businesses. So, you know, it might be an interesting discussion to see, okay, where do they find their place, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think there's a lot of really exciting, very impactful jobs in startups and scale-ups. It's just, it's a different kind of environment, as I'm thinking, compared to public sector, where these are typically very small teams that still need to grow, and a lot of growth needs to happen. And that's a very different environment to be, because like you need to change really quickly.
Yeah.
And you need to get a lot of stuff done, and it's... the more tunnel vision you have, the faster you can grow sometimes.
Yeah. Usually the tunnel vision is not the good one, but
exactly. In startups and scale-ups, it can be.
It can be. Yeah. Exactly. Where I come from, that's not a good one.
Exactly.
Okay. No, good. Yeah, maybe a bit more on a personal level. So what does this work, and you said also, where do people put their time?
Yeah.
So what does this mean personally to you?
I think this is the first job I've had or way I've spent my professional hours where I'm not looking for what's next.
Yeah.
So this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And that's a very peaceful experience, even though there's much more to be done and many things to achieve. But I think I found a place where I fit in different ways. So one, I spent a lot of time thinking about in the past, what were my moments of glory? Where in my professional career did I feel like I did something special?
Yeah.
And what was it that I did, and what was the conditions around me that enabled me to do that?
Yeah.
And for me, it was, I'm very good at coming up with new frameworks and connecting the dots between different fields.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm good at coming up with something smart and logical on the condition that other people can sell it. And then I met my team, and Jacqueline is an incredible saleswoman, and Lara is an incredible operational financial wizard, and I get to make our products, our investment products, and that was just a very good fit.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. And I can relate to that. The sales part is like, okay, yeah.
Exactly. I think knowing what you're good at and then finding people that are complementary to you, that's the biggest thing I can advise people.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely very good advice. And I think sometimes in the international organization environment, a bit of a challenge sometimes, because things are very much pre-structured. But at the same time, I'm hoping this is more like, I guess, from a personnel perspective, that sort of this way of thinking that you see in the companies that, well, your company, but also the companies that you represent or that you invest in, that way of thinking also goes back to the more bigger organizations, and that they become a little bit more flexible in their thinking there, which is really needed. And then might potentially also influence their political thinking, although, yeah, that depends on some other issues as well, I think. Yeah.
Maybe one more thing about kind of like where to work and how to think about where you could fit.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I was kind of like going back, like what is it I'm good at? What kind of people do I need around me? But also think about what it is you're good at and where that can have the most impact.
Yeah.
I think that's another important part of it. And I love that people are at their best and are at their most influential in different places. So I have friends who are internal activists in laggard multinational companies. But they're at their best trying to help these huge companies pivot strategies. I have people around me who are at their best in government. They have the patience to negotiate. They love the game of building coalitions.
Yeah.
And that's where they are at their best.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's people who easily get bored and are like quick to jump onto next topics, and maybe they are at their best as consultants. And understanding how you work and in what kind of environment that thrives, I think is also something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it, I guess it also, well, you need to be a little bit brave sometimes to make that decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's definitely true. Yeah. Reminds me of a chat I had with Karim Bellemare. I don't know if you know him. He's a philosopher. He's also going to be one of our guests. And he was, because we were talking about HR in general, and he has these posts on HR and how to transform it. And he was definitely making the point like, well, you know, if you really want to make a change, then go and join one of these bigger firms and try to make the change there, rather than, you know, you can go for some place where everybody has the same view. But if you want, you can also make an impact indeed in a bigger corporation or within government.
Yeah.
But it needs to suit you. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So the way I was once in a lecture of a, I think it was German professor, and I need to go back and find his name. He had a theory which I loved, but it starts a little bit odd. Find your naughty place.
Okay.
Find the place where you are slightly more naughty than the environment around you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that you're close enough to the norm to not be considered a cookie.
Yeah.
But you are a little bit out. So in your natural way of being, you are softly provoking and teasing and pulling.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that one. I recognize that actually. Okay,
yeah, exactly.
That's funny. That's funny. Okay. I always like to end with a open question. So if you could share a wish right now for what you would like to bring to the world, what would that be?
That's a big question. The biggest one, I think, for everyone is awareness. So at least for me, in the whole transition, whether it's about the personal choices I make or the work that I do, to just be aware of the choices that I'm making and the impact that those choices have.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't fly anymore, but I want to make a conscious decision on whether I fly or not.
Yeah.
That's related to the transition. And in the broader sense, I think just awareness of each other and where we're at in the world and how complex the world is, and to allow that complexity in rather than shut it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, embrace it or...
Well, that's next level, next level.
Embrace
it. But to at least keep our eyes open even when it gets hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. And thank you for this chat.
Yeah,
really enjoyed
you too.
It. And thank you for having us here at your office.
Yeah, thank you for coming. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. Well, I wish you all best of luck with what you're doing. And I think it's an amazing initiative. And yeah, really great and nice meeting you.
Likewise.
So thank you everyone for listening. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. And until the next time, bye-bye.